Welcome back to the podcast. The world has lost faith in science and medicine. The narrative is that we physicians are driven by greed. So let's change that narrative. So here to talk about that is Dr. Jordan Grummet, an internal medicine physician and hospice physician who's known in the financial independence circles as Doc G. He's been on the show previously to discuss his books, Taking Stock, A Hospice Doctor's Advice on Financial Independence, Building Wealth, and Living a Regret-Free Life, and most recently, The Purpose Code, How to Unlock Meaning, Maximize Happiness, and Leave a Lasting Legacy. So we'll be using his insights on purpose to give us a narrative we can use to help restore faith in science and in medicine. But first, a word from our sponsor. Hey, this is Brad Block, host of The Physician's Guide to Doctoring. This is a personal and professional development podcast for physicians where we have experts on the show that try to teach us everything we should have been learning while we were memorizing Krebs cycle. Doctors change lives every day, but what happens when life changes yours? A single injury, a sudden illness, your career, your income, your future can shift in an instant. The best physicians don't just plan for success, they protect it. At Set for Life Insurance, they believe financial security isn't a luxury, it's a necessity. True own occupation disability insurance ensures that no matter what happens, your future stays in your hands. Because protecting your income means protecting everything you've built. Visit drpodcastnetwork.co/setforlife today. Secure your future before life makes that choice for you. Dr. Jordan Grummet, thanks so much for coming back on the podcast.
Bradley Block, so happy to be here with you.
So let's get right into it. So people are using greed to undermine confidence in science and medicine, right? As if we're all driven by money. So let's start there. Does money actually buy happiness?
There is so much argument out there about whether money buys happiness. And in fact, there are a bunch of great studies. We can go into the details if you want, but there was a guy named Kahneman, a partner named Angus Deaton. They worked together 2010, 2012. They had a big study showing that up until about $70,000 of income a year, money did make people happy. But then after $70,000, it didn't. Then there was this guy, Matthew Killingsworth, who built on those studies and said, that's not necessarily true. If you're unhappy, making more money doesn't make you more happy. But if you're happy already, then you can actually make more than $70,000 and it starts to increase your happiness, though not to the same extent that it did for the first $70,000. Both of these studies were scientists, right? So both these studies were either retrospective or weekly prospective. Like the Kahneman study was totally retrospective, data collected for something else that they used. The Killingsworth data was prospective, but what they did is they like texted and emailed people like multiple times a week and asked them basic questions for a year or two. That's all fine and dandy, but there is better data out there. And the data that I usually point to is the Harvard Developmental Health Study, which actually started in the early 1900s and studied Harvard students. And what they did is they started by interviewing them every 2 years and doing questionnaires. Then they brought in their family members. Then they brought in controls from the Boston area. It ended up being thousands and thousands of people. And as time went on, they started doing blood tests and MRIs and EEGs. They did tons of studies on these people. And after 80 years, they actually asked really basic question, what makes people happy? And when they did this, they found that it wasn't money, it wasn't career, it wasn't achievements. What they actually found makes people happy is interpersonal relationships, interpersonal connections. And so you can look at some of that data from Kahneman and Killingsworth, and we argue over and over again about that. But I would look at the Harvard Adult Developmental Health data and say that money probably won't get you there, but interpersonal connections, people probably will. And I think that's intimately related to purpose, because I think if you live a purposeful life and if you follow your purpose in a really intentional way, it actually will connect you to other people. It'll draw them to you because you are lit up by what you're doing. And like a moth to a flame, they're going to want to be involved with you.
So ultimately, the short answer is up to a point, right? If you're living in poverty, getting more than that will get you, like, I think the answer that you said earlier was 70,000. So up to seven, yeah. Under 70,000 a year, when you're struggling to pay, basically you're a resident or make or less, you are struggling with your bills, you will then get peace of mind and not have that anxiety anymore. But beyond that, the answer is no. is ultimately chasing the almighty dollar is not what brings you happiness, right? What you're saying is it's chasing social connections is what brings you happiness.
Let's even drop all the data and look at pop culture. Think about the most wealthy people you know in the world, and are they happy? I don't know. We're not going to give them a questionnaire, et cetera, but you and I can watch TV. We can see them. We can see how they interact in the world because they're famous people because they're really rich. And the question is, are they happy? And what I think you'll find is some of them appear happy. Many of them don't. But clearly money didn't solve the problem, right?
Yes.
Money didn't fix the problem. I love to talk about Steve Jobs, one of the richest people and also created some of the coolest stuff in the world. He lived in some ways a kind of miserable life. Like, he didn't talk to his daughter for like years and years. He didn't even admit that she was his daughter. Like, he got kicked out of the company he founded. Like, the people who worked with him said he was miserable to work.
Yeah.
So money clearly doesn't solve that issue. I think it's helpful on some level, but common sense would tell us it doesn't solve everything.
It could be that they're happier, but it's hard to tell through all the Botox. There might be that. They're
the facial muscles exactly. Aren't moving this.
They're ecstatic under all that Botox. They just can't express it anymore. But yes, that makes so much sense. But there are some people that, like Jack Black, right? Look at Jack Black. Like, he goes anywhere and he looks like he's having a blast. We don't know what's going on behind closed doors, but if money bought happiness, you would expect all those billionaires to behave like him all the time because they're just loving life.
Yeah, I don't know her maiden name, but Mackenzie Bezos versus Jeff Bezos. Who looks happier?
Yeah.
Mackenzie Bezos looks a lot happier. Yes. She's given away a lot of her money.
Yeah. The saying, whoever said money can't buy happiness clearly hasn't given away enough is something I've heard. And she's given away more than her share. So you've worked in hospice and you've had countless conversations with doctors at all stages, just through your career, both in medicine and in the fire movement and you're being a blogger and an author. So what have you seen as the deeper reason that people in medicine and science keep showing up? Like, what is it? Since we're saying money doesn't buy happiness, is it the paycheck that all your doctor friends are still working for? Or is there something else?
The only doctor friends I've ever had who are working for the paycheck are the ones who are so in debt that they have no choice. But erasing those people, listen, you and I know this, and probably a lot of people, if they're physicians, listen to know this, but becoming a doctor's painful. Practicing is painful. Like, I was a general internist before I did hospice, and I took care of sick people. And man, like, if I was doing it for the money, I don't think I would have lasted all those years because it was difficult. Patients died and they got sick, and you've got to be there and support families and question yourself whether you even did things right.
Yeah.
And there are the threats of the lawsuits. And then there's all the administrative BS that we now have to do and filling out charts and paperwork and electronic medical records. If you were doing it for money, here's the thing. You made it into medical school, got through residency. You've got skills and talent. If making money is your thing, don't do medicine. It's too hard. Go do something else. Start a business. Work in corporate America. There's so many better ways to make money for someone who has a doctorate degree and has that skill set. And you can do those things without constantly being on call, constantly making decisions that affect people's lives. And I would even carry this into research. So it's one thing. So researchers don't make usually as much money as the kind of more clinical positions. But if you are going to enter a life of doing research, you are going to come up against failure over and over again. To be a scientific researcher is to study these incredibly difficult hypotheses, to repeat the same actions over and over again, to fail and have to figure out why and try again. It's a deeply frustrating life if you don't have passion for it, right? And so the question is, what causes people not to burn out? And there are people who've answered this. Daniel Pink talks about behavioral theory, right? And internal motivation. And it's autonomy, mastery, and purpose, right? Autonomy, mastery, and purpose. Most physicians don't feel they have autonomy anymore. They've been brought out by private equity. They're working in an academic center, so they don't have that. Mastery, a lot of us hopefully have after working for decades and decades, but we constantly have the medical legal system questioning our mastery, as well as
is it
all
having
of these
mastery
different,
or is it the pursuit?
What?
Is it having mastery, or is it the pursuit of mastery?
It's the pursuit of getting better and learning more.
Okay.
So you do the correction is a correct correction, but I still think we continuously have things getting in our way, whether it be paperwork,
whether it be
right. If it was, medical ecosystem, if it was the, yes, there are some like academic surgeons and academic physicians who are pushing the envelope of what can be done. Like I know some of my colleagues at the academic centers doing like head and free flaps and head and neck cancer surgeries. They're figuring out what they can do to help these people more. So that I can see. But for a lot of us, we end up doing the same things over and over again, and it gets monotonous and stagnating. And you're not pursuing mastery. You're just doing the same things you do every single day.
But this is exactly my point. What keeps you from burning out? We don't have autonomy. We may or may not have mastery. If you have a physician who comes in every day and does the hard work, the thing keeping them there, it's purpose.
Yeah.
It's a deep connection to the work. And look, I didn't have that. That was the hardest thing for me, is I was a great doctor. One of the things I'm best at in life is being a doctor, but I didn't feel in the end the true sense of purpose. And so I found a piece that I didn't feel that purpose in, which was hospice medicine.
Yeah.
But I left being a general internist because that thread wasn't there. So think about all the people who are showing up every day, doing the research, seeing the sickest of patients, even going into a primary care office and taking care of people's colds and people's wellness visits and that. You don't have autonomy. You may or may not have mastery. You better have purpose.
So then how do we start to dismantle the myth of the greedy doctor or the scientist that's been corrupted by big pharma and the healthcare system, and they just work for a hospital and they're doing research? These civil servants that have been working right at the NIH doing lifelong research, that's what you're talking about, like pipetting. And yet the American public and a lot of places around the world have lost faith in these people who, as you said, they don't make much money and they do these monotonous things over. I tried pipetting when I was a resident. I had to do research on MUC5B, mucin producing in a mouse model, and Arabidopsis thaliana plants. No, so I never would, but they do that. So, they show up every day doing that, and it's not so for the paycheck. So why? And you said purpose. So
why?
Yeah.
Look, you asked two different questions. Yeah. You just asked why. But
a podcast, no. Don't stack questions. Yeah. I'm sorry.
But before you asked, how do we let people know? So there's two questions, why we do it. And I think the answer is, again, what keeps us from burning out? Autonomy, mastery, purpose. In this case, I think it's purpose is the key, which is keeping them there. Not purpose of making money, because if that's your purpose, you're going to burn out also, because it's the hard work is just too hard. It's people are deeply devoted and connected to this work. Now, the bigger question is how we deal with the fact that the public at large sees something more sinister. And so I can announce to you right now, I've actually written a third book, which is exactly about this. And it's a complicated answer. So let me start with the background. The background is that there are third parties who are leveraging our healthcare system as a piggy bank. Those third parties include pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, private equity and venture capital, sometimes even the government, electronic medical records companies, all of them are. And they're doing a few things. One is they're taking away from the medical system and not adding. Good example, electronic medical records companies, after 20, 25 years of them being implemented and after all the billions of dollars companies like Epic has made, pretty much the data shows that people aren't any better off. Like, quality of healthcare isn't better. There are less of some mistakes, but then more of others. And so what we're seeing is these third parties are taking lots of money out of the system. But what's even more sinister is they've also pitted doctor against patient in order to abscond with the money while no one is looking. And we can see all these different examples of the insurance companies blaming doctors and the pharmaceutical companies blaming doctors and the electronic medical records companies blaming doctors and venture capital and private equity blaming doctors. And they're doing that because if they take the main stakeholders in the system, because my belief is there are only two main stakeholders, right? There are doctors. And when I say doctors, I'm not just talking about doctors. I'm talking about nurses, social workers,
healthcare professionals,
PTs,
yes.
OTs. They're healthcare providers.
Use the word provider. You can say it. You can say it on this show.
There's healthcare providers. Yeah. And then there's the people who need healthcare. And that's it. Everyone else is on the side. Those are the two main stakeholders. And we've let all these third parties leverage us to take all the money out of the system and get in between us. It's a fact. We know this. Our healthcare system in the U.S. costs more than anyone else's, but we're not getting any better quality of care. So what do we do? And these third parties are a little bit more sinister because they're trying to convince us that the doctors are the cause of the problem to keep you from actually looking at them.
That is
so
very similar to politics.
So here's what you do. And this is, again, going to be an answer that you probably weren't thinking was going to come, but let me back it up. So the answer is what I call shared storytelling. The problem is we have an intimacy gap between doctors and patients. Patients come in and give us all their intimacy. They tell us everything about their lives, their worries, their concerns, et cetera. And we as doctors often sit there stone-faced and don't give them anything back. And so we have unilateral intimacy. And when we are the only shareholders in the system that matter, we're having trouble coming together and pushing for change together as the main stakeholders because we don't have the binding of intimacy. The way we get there is that doctors and healthcare providers have to start telling their stories. Not in the exam room, because it's impossible to do it there.
Okay, thank you.
In the exam room, your patient comes in for chest pain. You need to talk to them about their chest pain. But in the world, if you think about it, we as doctors are really great at telling patients what we know. We're out there lecturing about healthcare and diabetes and the newest meds, but we never tell them who we are. We're not telling them the stories of staying up late at night and worrying about that patient. We're not telling them about the PTSD. We're not telling them about the fear and guilt and anxiety. And because they don't know this, they don't feel any intimacy from us. They don't feel connected to us. So here's how this plays out. Because we've actually seen the story already, how shared intimacy and storytelling actually changes the world. We need a healthcare revolution. Where else in the world have we had revolutions, healthcare and otherwise? What about Upton Sinclair? Upton Sinclair wrote a book called The Jungle about the meatpacking industry. At the time, basically, he was a socialist. And so he saw these meatpacking workers were being totally abused, horrible conditions. So he wrote The Jungle, a fictional story about what was happening. Strangely enough, the American people got outraged. They didn't fix the life of the workers. The reason they got outraged was because the cleanliness of the food was a problem. And immediately after that, you had legislation basically about how we handle food. But here's what's exciting about that. 20 to 30 years later, we had our first laws about collective bargaining. Stories cause revolutions and change the world. We know this. We've seen it over and over again. In fact, the NHS, Britain's healthcare system, NHS didn't exist, I believe, until the 1940s and 1950s. There was a singular reason the NHS got passed. If you look at the historical books, it was because there was an author, a physician, who wrote a book called The Citadel, and it was all about the atrocities of the healthcare system and how people were dying and didn't need to in rural parts of the UK. And that book was actually credited with what caused the NHS to pass.
Hold on, because you said Upton Sinclair's The Jungle. People didn't care about the workers. They cared about their food. They cared about themselves, not about other people. So here we are, doctors telling them about ourselves. But what you're saying is people do things that are self-serving, not caring about other people. You didn't say that, but that's what I gleaned from the Upton Sinclair story.
I think originally they were worried about the healthiness of the food. But like I said, within 20 or 30 years, we have the first collective bargaining laws. We have the first unions.
Yes.
And so whether we recognized it or not, that was one of those inflection points that eventually led to more safety for workers, unionization, collective bargaining, etc. And we know this is how the world works. We need a healthcare revolution. If we want to fix this problem as physicians, we have to start telling our stories publicly. We have to close that intimacy gap between doctors and patients because only then we, the main stakeholders, can stand up all together and force revolutionary change. It's the only way it's going to happen. There are too many entrenched interests in medicine. There's too many people who are trying to paint physicians as the bad guys.
Yeah. And you know what? That reminds me a lot about politics, right?
Yeah.
People are taking advantage of the fact that they can sow a narrative that pits us against each other, right? They're creating these culture wars, these class wars. that are self-serving for them because it divides us in ways that we wouldn't otherwise be divided. So it sounds very similar. I
mean, yeah. And again, what we're talking about is revolutionary change. And revolutionary change, whether it be politics, whether it be healthcare, it's all the same thing. What it ultimately needs is legislation. And you either get legislation through our congressional, administrative, and legislative bodies, but when there are too many entrenched interests, the only way it happens is when people stand up and refuse. When people refuse to stand on the bus after a tiring day of work, it's the story that eventually brings legislative change. Like civil rights started with a story of a woman who wouldn't give up her seat on the bus.
Yeah.
And the entrenched interest, millions of them, all the people who didn't want this to happen, couldn't overcome the main stakeholders coming together and forcing change. Stories change the world. I think if we're talking about the colorization of physicians as greedy, disinterested, and self-serving, we need to bring back this idea that researchers come to their work with a deeper sense of purpose. But we've done a horrible job of demonstrating that to the other stakeholders, our patients, and to the public at large. We've got to tell our stories. We've got to do it over and over again. There are many ways in which this is already happening on a smaller level. We just have to continue building and growing it.
Or on a larger level, the show The Pit.
Yeah. Perfect example. And even a little bit Grey's Anatomy, all of them show a side of being a physician, that deep, intense storytelling. And so I experienced this personally. So I wrote a medical blog from like 2003 till 2020. And my patients would eventually find it online. And often they would come in and they'd be like, I read your blog. And they would say something like, I never knew my doctor went through that. Like when you come in, you as a primary care doctor, I'd have 20 patients coming to see me in a day. But I also took care of my patients in the hospital and the nursing home. So it's quite possible that 5 minutes before I walk into your room, I just got the call that my favorite patient just died in the ICU. And then I'm walking in to see you and I'm an hour late and I'm depressed. And so I might be a little short with you.
Yeah.
Because I'm a human being. But you don't know that. You don't know my struggles. You don't have any empathy towards me because I haven't shared any intimacy with you. You don't know what my life looks like.
Hey there, it's Brad. As someone who's passionate about podcasting, I've always thought there should be more support for physicians who want to share their stories and expertise. That's why we're launching Dr. Podcast Network.
We're bringing together a community of physician podcasters with one goal in mind, to provide the tools, connections, and resources you need to grow your show. So whether you've been podcasting for a while or maybe you're just starting, we've designed this network to support you every step of the way, and we're going to help each other rise, not compete.
If this sounds like something you'd benefit from, we'd love for you to join us as we get closer to launch. So you can sign up at drpodcastnetwork.co for early access. Stay tuned for more details in the coming weeks. Really looking forward to what we can create together. Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
Dr. Podcast Network, where doctors podcast.
That's interesting. That's interesting because what we've always been taught has been the patient deserves nothing but your best self. You're human, but the patient deserves nothing but your best self. And so now you're saying that narrative needs to change for them to realize. And how
in
do
the
we
exam
do
room.
Right, but you can't always bring
OR.
That. But like you just said, we can't always bring that. Yes, because we're humans. And so it always started and ended with you need to be your best self for every single patient. And what you're saying is you can't always bring that and they need to know why. And so we need to start telling our stories. Okay, so where do we do it? Our stories, like how do we get these narratives out there? Because we don't always all have Noah Wiley on speed dial, or I think it has to go, it has to be said, Scrubs, I still think is the best medical show of all time. Or we need like a West Wing, but doctor version, right? So how do we get this out there? How do we start
blogs, podcasts, public speaking at your local Y, short stories, novels? It was A.J. Cronin who wrote The Citadel. It was a novel. The guy wrote a novel. He happened to also be an internist.
But like, people care about stuff that affects them, like not other people. Like, read about my story. Here's my story. Like, they want to hear about themselves more than someone else. No?
Well, if you're going to use that argument, then why would anyone read anything other than specifically something that's self-serving? But I'll tell you, almost every person is a patient at some point in time.
Yeah.
And so if they do want to hear about medical stuff because they've been in that room, they've been pissed off at the doctor because the doctor was late, the doctor was short with them, or they had a doctor who saved their life and they're just so glad. The story of medicine and healthcare is the story of humanity. It is our story. It is about us. It's about every single one of us. And if it isn't today, it will be, because all of us are going to either have an accident, a cancer, or be on our deathbed at some point. We're all going to go through it at some point.
But it can't be spun in a complainy way, right? Like, life of a doctor is really hard. It can illustrate ways in which it's hard, but it has to be, here's an interesting story, and then it goes through the highs and lows. I think that's the only...
I think you're going to have a little bit of everything.
Yeah.
But this is a story of persistence. Why? Why do people keep on being doctors even though burnout is at like 40 or 50%? Why are we becoming doctors and staying as doctors even though all of us have PTSD from residency? All of us have PTSD from those decisions we made that didn't go well? Why would we stay? Doctoring is an act of love. It's always been an act of love. You can worry about it being whiny and complainy, and sometimes there'll be doctors who write something that's whiny and complainy, but if we all did it, if more people talked about it, I think ultimately the public would see that doctoring is an act of love, it's an act of service, and it costs a lot to the people who practice it. But how would they know that?
Okay, so this conversation ended up taking a way different direction than I thought it was going to. So I do want to get back to one of my intentions, which was, I think in today's social media age, sound bites work, right? Taglines work, short, quick, to the point. And so I want to workshop some sound bites so that we can use that, in addition to the long form content that you're referring to, some shorter form content as well.
I don't think you're giving enough weight to how short form content can actually portray these ideas. Think about all the wonderful doctor poets there are out there.
I had him on the show a couple of months ago, Sayed Tabatabai. He was a masterful poet on Twitter. And he created these beautiful stories during COVID. Then I said it when I interviewed him, it had me crying on the toilet because that's when I would scroll the internet.
I started writing poetry and I've had a few poems published in like the Annals of Internal Medicine, Journal of General Internal Medicine. Half a page, a page. I will tell you that's some of the most impactful writing. I've written books, I've written blog posts, I've done lots and lots of writing, written articles. Some of the most impactful things I've written have been less than a page. 20, 30 words, 40 words.
Okay, so it's not just longer form stuff. But my point being, like, when someone approaches you online and says, you are just a shill for Big Pharma, that comes up over and over again. What would be a quick retort that makes your point about us being purpose-driven and not profit-driven? Like, I came up with a couple.
Sure. Okay, here's a good one. Maybe 4 or 5 sentences.
Yeah.
Data shows your average physician, let's say, makes $300,000 to $350,000 a year, right?
Yeah.
Or pick a number, but let's guess it's somewhere around 350. Other data shows that your average physician receives less than $1,000 from pharmaceutical companies a year in payments. Pharmaceutical companies make billions of dollars a year and beat almost every other company in the S&P 500 on their return on investment.
But that's going to undermine their faith in pharmaceuticals. Like, we want them to take their medicines, right? Like, we want them to get their vaccines. We don't want them to turn to supplements and acupuncture and the wellness industry that arguably makes 3 times as much as the pharmaceutical industry, right? They're the ones who are undermining us. I think this dichotomy of working for a profit-driven system without being profit-driven yourself. Like, the hospital might have a bottom line,
right? But I'm the one talking directly to patients. Like, I owe it to my patients. Like, I show up every day because I love my patients, not because of some pharmaceutical. I'm having trouble. When I came up with, you can work in a profit-driven system without being profit-driven yourself. Or most scientists I know aren't chasing money. They're chasing answers. Those are a couple.
But so someone says you're a shill for the pharmaceutical company. I'd say, okay, what do you base that on? Where's the credible evidence? Like I said, the data shows that physicians make a 300th. Your average physician makes less than $1,000 a year from pharmaceutical payments. If you are a shill for pharmaceutical companies, you're wasting your time because all you need to do is see an extra patient or two the whole year.
Yeah.
And you've made more money than you're going to make from pharmaceutical companies. It makes no sense. We don't actually get paid very much. There are a select small number of physicians right. who get paid a huge amount by pharmaceutical companies. Most of those people either don't practice or are an exceedingly small number of physicians. Like, so there are about 1 million either physicians, dentists, chiropractors, people who may or may not, well, chiropractors, but may or may not prescribe medicines.
Yeah.
You're talking about less than 1,000 who make any real substantial amount of money. Yeah. And the data's all there. It's all been collected.
Yes. So I think, yes, I think that sounds like a great reply. I should have come with more of these, right? Because it's the yes and. Yes, doctors do make money from pharmaceutical companies, but it is 0.01% of their revenue for the year. So it's not going to change their decisions. Yeah.
Doctors do have issues with pharmaceutical companies. We are unduly influenced sometimes by them in ways that we shouldn't be. There's also reasons for that.
That's why they spend the money. Because it does influence.
But it's not the major thrust of what's happening in healthcare. In this case, I disagree with you. I think the pharmaceutical companies are doing some things really dirty and wrong and underhanded. And the reason why pharmaceuticals are so expensive is not because doctors shouldn't be prescribing them, or not that doctors are having someone push their arm behind their back and forcing them to prescribe only the expensive ones. A lot of the times, it's because pharmaceutical companies are exploiting a system to make money.
Yes.
You and I abide by some version of the Hippocratic Oath, right? Pharmaceutical companies don't abide by any type of oath to patients. They abide by their fiduciary responsibility to their shareholders, which has nothing to do with taking care of patients and everything to do with making money.
Same and for the fact, insurance companies.
What? Yeah, yeah. And in fact, there are laws on the books that say that companies can't act as physicians. Non-physicians can't act as physicians. So these pharmaceutical companies can say, we're not your physician. We have a fiduciary responsibility to our shareholder, and that means that we have to increase the price of this cancer drug to $100,000 a year, even though your patients can't afford it, and some of them are ultimately going to die because they don't have enough insurance coverage.
But what about the researchers that work at those pharmaceutical companies? What about those scientists?
What about them? What's your question?
My question is
their purpose.
Are they corrupted also by the system and are profit driven, or are they the ones who are also looking for answers?
They're not making much more than a practicing physician. For all the billions of dollars the pharmaceutical companies make, these hardworking researchers are probably making a living wage.
Yeah.
Maybe it's a few $100,000 a year, and they're very purposefully pursuing a passion, which is to create these drugs that ultimately will save lives. It's not their fault that the pharmaceutical companies will only make them available to certain people.
But what I'm saying
even
is,
even for
is
them,
there,
it still helps people.
We want people to take their medicine. And if we're telling them these conversations are necessary, but what I'm trying to say is we need to control the narrative in such a way that they do take their medicine. They do take their vaccines because the people that did the research that created these are people who are purpose-driven and not profit-driven. Even though the companies that they work for are, because otherwise they're turning to the wellness influencers who are going to sell
but
them.
The wellness influencers are just as bad, if not worse.
I know, but I'm trying to pull them away. My point is, I'm trying to pull them away from
I think
them.
You have to remind people that the right treatment is the right treatment, even if some third party is trying to fleece you and use the fact you need it to have the treatment. It's still the right treatment. So if you have the insurance and you can get it covered, or if you have enough money to get it covered, it is still the right treatment that may save your life.
No, it's not. No, they're just trying to make money off of me. There, I know. Well, I know this wellness influencer told me.
But you as their advisor, and hopefully as we tell our stories, they trust us more because they know us. And you can say, yes, they're making money off you, But I, a third party who makes no money off of giving you these medicines now, remember, less than 0.01% of our income comes from pharmaceutical companies. It just isn't worth it to make money that way. I, as a third party, are telling you this is deeply important for you, regardless of whether they're trying to get money out of you or not. That's where the allyship comes. That's where being the stakeholders who are united comes. And I think ultimately, long term, if we stand up together, healthcare providers and patients, we'll be able to actually affect legislative change that causes curbs on this. Look, the Biden administration started, right? They got the cost of insulin, which spiked all of a sudden out of nowhere over the last decade. They started curbing the cost of insulin. There's so many examples, but this is the path we have. We are past having our government do the right thing. We're at the point where we need healthcare revolution. And I'm not talking about armed revolution. I'm talking about the important stakeholders standing up and doing what needs to be done. And it's hard. Revolutions are not easy. It takes a lot. And that's why we have to start telling our stories.
So when
your patients need to trust you. So when you tell them to take the pharmaceutical, they do, because they know who you are. They see you.
So when is that book coming out? When can we expect it?
September. It's in editing right now, but it's been written. It's actually a book that I've been writing for years based on a talk I've been giving to medical societies for years about the power of shared storytelling.
And what can we expect it to be called? Workshopping titles.
There's a working title. Right now it's titled Leverage, because we're talking about these third parties and how they lever the healthcare system and what we can do about it.
Yeah.
But that'll probably change by the time it comes out.
Got it. Okay. The Healthcare Revolution, or Leverage, or some such title. Expect it in September 26th from Dr. Jordan Grumman. Thank you so much for sharing your time and expertise on purpose. And hopefully we can use all this to shift the narrative and start a revolution.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. I have a favor to ask. You listened to the episode until the end, which means you either fell asleep or you really liked the episode. So please share it, or like it, or comment on a social media post, or write us a 5-star review, something. It would really help me out. And maybe what you learned from this episode can help someone else too. The views expressed in this episode are those of the interviewer and interviewee, and don't represent the views of their employer or even their significant other. Even though the magic of podcasting make it sound like I'm talking directly to you, this is not a doctor-patient relationship, and this is not medical advice or financial advice or really any advice. Thank us again for listening to The Physician's Guide to Doctoring.